This relationship will provide more opportunities for us and for exporters and companies to compete.
Exchanging words, the United States and China talk trade. It's Thursday, July 20th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us online for Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a U.S. general assesses North Korea's missiles, getting tough on ivory, present view of a Myanmar assassination 70 years ago, rewiring depression, and competing robots from around the world. We're just getting started. Stay with us for VOA Asia. Talks aimed at breaking down trade barriers between the United States and China appeared to hit a snag Wednesday in Washington as the two sides canceled news conferences that were scheduled for the end of the meeting. As the talks began, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin called for a more fair and balanced economic relationship between the United States and China. Mnuchin said there is still work to do to achieve a balanced relationship based on reciprocity.
This relationship will provide more opportunities for us and for exporters and companies to compete. This means working to lift foreign ownership restrictions so U.S. companies can participate more fully in China's growing financial services sector. It means working with China to resolve barriers to trade in its information and communications technology. Finally, it means a high standard of openness in communicating new and revised policies, regulations, and statistics that our companies can efficient business and efficient business decisions.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said U.S. imports of Chinese goods far outweigh U.S. exports to China because the U.S. market has fewer restrictions on Chinese investment. The U.S. trade deficit with China reached nearly $350 billion last year. Ross said it is time to rebalance the trade and investment relationship. Scott Kennedy directs the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the talks are crucial and the obstacles U.S. businesses face in China are substantial.
I'm not sure that these talks are going to bear the type of fruit that Secretaries Mnuchin and Ross hoped that they would.
Mnuchin said he hoped China would lift foreign ownership restrictions in its financial service sector to allow more U.S. participation and remove barriers to trade in its information and communication technology sector.
China had promised when it joined the WTO by 2006 to remove restrictions for investment in financial services in China and banking. And we're 11 years past that date, and there's still huge obstacles there. In addition, American companies have a difficult time investing and doing business in the high-tech sector in China, including investment, selling to the Chinese government. These are all difficulties. And he's looking for things more than pledges to eventually get these markets opened, which we've had a very difficult time, obviously, achieving so far.
Well, China's Vice Premier Wang Yang told the same luncheon that Beijing has its own concerns to be addressed in the talks, including outdated U.S. export controls for high technology products.
The U.S. Maintains a variety of controls of its exports to countries that are not allies in high tech. There are some constraints about investing in the United States when there's potential concerns about national security. These are rules that have been on the books for a long time. The Chinese have complained about them for a long time. I don't expect to see much movement on this either, even though it's an important Chinese ask.
One report suggests that U.S.-China tensions on trade are increasing with the possibility of U.S. tariffs on Chinese steel exports.
I think we're going to see an announcement before too long by the Trump administration to impose some types of penalties, tariffs, quotas against steel from China and perhaps several other countries, as a part of their effort to protect the American steel industry based on the concern that overdependence on imports is a threat to American national security.
While not convinced of the logic of the argument, Scott Kennedy said it is a tool used by the Trump administration to try to gain leverage with China. He said both countries are led by economic nationalists with different motivations and objectives. However, he does not see the relationship devolving into a trade war. He described the relationship as complex, a mixture of shared interests, as well as disagreements and competition. Chinese Vice Premier Wang Yang told the U.S.-China Business Council on Tuesday both sides must realize that given the depth of business cooperation, neither Chinese nor Americans can do without goods from the other country. He said trading cooperation between the two countries is a realistic choice for both sides, but he warned confrontation will immediately damage the interests of both. Washington and Beijing govern the world's two biggest economies, but China sells more than $300 billion more to U.S. customers each year than American firms sell to China. Analysts say domestic politics in both nations make it difficult for negotiators to make progress on trade issues. The U.S. Treasury chief said the U.S. and China made progress earlier in their trade relations as a result of the April summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping, with China's markets being open to U.S. beef processors and American credit rating agencies gaining new information to assess the creditworthiness of Chinese corporations. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. South Korea's push for talks with North could backfire. Asia's richest man comes under pressure in China. Deadly crash of Myanmar military jet blamed on bad weather. Army general among Thais convicted of human trafficking. Myanmar grapples with legacy of independence hero 70 years after assassination. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories, and there's a lot more, too, when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and also our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. A senior U.S. military officer told lawmakers Tuesday he does not believe North Korea, which tested its first intercontinental ballistic missile July 4th, has the capacity to strike the U.S. mainland with any degree of accuracy. Air Force General Paul Selva, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had this exchange of testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
I do agree in principle with the assessment that the North Koreans are moving quickly to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile capability. I, however, am not sanguine that the test on the 4th of July demonstrates that they have the capacity to strike the United States with any degree of accuracy or reasonable confidence of success. What the experts tell me is that North Koreans have yet to demonstrate the capacity to do the guidance and control that would be required to take
Yes, no, I was only referring to range.
Yes, sir, on range, they clearly have the capability. I do agree with the intelligence community and others that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is an arms proliferator. There's no evidence that they have engaged in proliferation of their long-range ballistic missile technology, but they have proliferated every other weapon system that they've ever invented. So it's a pretty clear pathway to the potential proliferation of these kinds of weapon systems.
Selva said he is reasonably confident in the ability of U.S. intelligence community to monitor the testing, but not the deployment of these missile systems. He said the North Korea regime is very good at camouflage, concealment, and deception of such weapons. Ken Goss is director of the International Affairs Group of the Center for Naval Analysis, and he tells VOA Selva's assessment is accurate.
They really haven't gone through the amount of tests, and the technology hasn't been developed yet by the North Koreans to do a variety of things. While they may be able to exhibit range capabilities on their missiles, the ability to do reentry into the Earth's atmosphere has not been proven that they have developed that capability. The accuracy of their missiles has not been proven. And so what the vice chairman said, I think, is an accurate statement. They have not proven the ability to do anything other than possibly have a range on their missiles that can possibly reach part of the United States. the North Koreans, especially on the missiles that are indigenously developed, we believe that probably the Hwasong 14 is an indigenously developed missile system, they have shown rapid progress, especially in the last few years. So it doesn't entirely surprise me that they have gotten to where they have now. And I suspect that if they keep at this pace over the next couple of years, they're going to make another major breakthroughs in their missile technology. The North Koreans are putting significant effort and resources toward this. There doesn't seem to be any indication that they're willing to slow down that pace, because the engagement that would be necessary to cause them to slow down their testing program just isn't in place.
While Air Force General Paul Selva has told lawmakers that he's relatively confident in the intelligence community's monitoring of North Korea's testing, but not deployment, Ken Goss describes in general some of the technology that's being employed.
We have satellite and other sorts of intelligence that is able to evaluate the North Korean missile system. I mean, we're able to track the missiles. The big problem is, if these are road mobile missiles, being able to get significant warning on when the test will occur to gain certain types of intelligence, especially on early trajectory intelligence on the missiles. But, you know, for the most part, we're gathering a lot of intelligence on what their capabilities are.
Ken Goss cautioned against attempting to shoot down one of North Korea's missiles, saying it is not clear how Pyongyang might react. Asked about a preemptive strike against the North, General Selva said while that's an option, that needs to be seriously thought through, given the potential consequences. Happening now in Asia, Indonesia has renamed part of the contested South China Sea, pushing back against the most powerful maritime claimant, China. A deputy maritime affairs minister in Jakarta says the North Natuna Sea, northwest of the island of Borneo, is in line with oil and gas exploration projects with similar titles. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happier with us today on VOA Asia. The illegal ivory trade has decimated elephant populations across parts of Africa, and this week, delegates and activists from across the world are gathering in Geneva for a meeting of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. As Henry Ridgewell reports, activists want tougher enforcement of regulations to tackle the organized criminal gangs behind the ivory trade, which is estimated at $23 billion per year.
Shuidong in southern China, a hub, investigators say, for the smuggling of ivory poached from African elephants. Secretly filmed footage shows a network of safe houses where the goods are on display. An estimated 80% of ivory destined for China passes through Shuidong.
This town has emerged as probably the biggest hub in the world for illegal trade in ivory tusks. We first came across the footprints of this group in Tanzania in 2014. The country has lost half its elephants in 5 years, the biggest loss in Africa.
As Tanzania began to clamp down on smuggling, the gangs moved to Mozambique. Investigators secretly recorded one of the traffickers describing the trade through the Mozambican port of Pemba.
We're able to move anything through Pemba. Everyone there has been bought up. The customs clearance agent. The customs also gets a share of the money.
Investigators say the evidence shows smugglers operate with impunity.
There was a few cases where they had some tusks seized, but they were never arrested. And they sort of saw these seizures as really a business expense rather than a worry that they might get arrested.
Hong Kong authorities confiscated ivory worth $10 million earlier this month. China plans to ban the trade by the end of 2017. But John Seller, former chief enforcement officer at CITES, told VOA via Skype there is too much focus on the trade and not enough on the criminals involved.
There is the speculation involved here, that there is undoubtedly money laundering, to my mind. This is a much more complex issue.
Sellart says CITES lacks the teeth to enforce its regulations.
Organized criminal networks are now major players in all forms or many forms of wildlife trafficking. And you need to bring an organized law enforcement response to that.
Without that enforcement, activists warn ivory poaching will likely continue until the criminal networks are investigated and dismantled. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the agency investigating the fatal police shooting of an Australian woman in Minnesota, says one of the officers was startled by a loud noise just moments before his partner fired the deadly shot. Justine Diamond, a mediation meditation teacher and bride-to-be, was killed late Saturday after she reported a possible sexual assault. VOA Asia Facebook has the top stories every day. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Long lines wrapped around the block of downtown Yangon's historic Secretariat building on Wednesday, with school children, adults, and groups of friends waiting to get a rare glimpse of Myanmar's history. That's because on July 19, 1947, political rivals gunned down 9 people, including Aung San, the father of future Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. 70 years later, the killings are enmeshed in the national psyche, but as Myanmar, also known as Burma, emerges from decades of military rule, the legacy of Aung San is gaining new scrutiny, with some like Khin Cha Win, director of the Yangon-based think tank, the Tapadipa Institute, wondering whether the official version of his life fails to capture a far more complex portrait.
For half a century, it's been just like official hagiography. He's a martyr, and then his story is taught even in primary school, and everyone knows it by heart, and they keep on repeating that. But now, well, especially now with the new openness, you know, and the new generation and the benefits of things like the internet, of course, people are starting to look even deeper.
Aung San is cast as an anti-colonial freedom fighter who founded the army and signed the historic Panglong Peace Agreement with the ethnic armed groups. His tragic death in his early 30s scuttled chances of peace and an independent federal union. Glossed over in the narrative are inconvenient details such as Aung San's role in founding the Burma Communist Party, his ties to the Japanese who occupied the country during World War II. He eventually switched sides to help the Allied forces, his less than perfect relations with ethnic groups, and his political influences.
On a very casual level, I would say that even if he had lived, you know, he would have had a huge task before him. And it doesn't mean that Myanmar would have been on a better path if he had been in charge. The rebellions after independence might not have happened, you know. So the thing is that the people after him handled those things very badly. But certain aspects of his life are overlooked. Do people know, how many people in Myanmar know that he was a founder member of the Burma Communist Party? I would say very few. He leans very much towards a kind of a centralized authoritarian state. Of course, he borrowed heavily from, well, the Leninist, Stalinist, you know, models of that day. And there's really quite a bit of doubt whether he would have really tolerated a real multi-party democracy.
His daughter Aung San Suu Kyi, who came to power after the 2015 elections as part of Myanmar's transition to democracy, has helped reinforce the official narrative by naming peace talks launched last year as the 21st Century Panglong Conference. Her party, the National League for Democracy, has also expressed conflicted opinions about Aung San, who remains esteemed and popular in the country. Our thanks to Joe Freeman in Yangon for contributing this story. Developing at this hour in Asia, a Thai army general was one of the most prominent figures found guilty Wednesday in a major human trafficking trial that included more than 103 defendants accused of involvement in a modern-day slavery trade. The defendants were arrested in 2015 after 36 bodies were discovered in shallow graves in southern Thailand. Visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the World Health Organization says that there are over 350 million people worldwide who suffer or have suffered from depression. They classify it as the leading cause of disability around the globe. There are all kinds of therapies and a lot of drugs designed to provide relief to people who suffer. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us there's one new therapy that uses magnets, and it seems to work.
This is what treatment for depression often looks like. There are all kinds of drugs called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors that can tweak a person's brain chemistry and help alleviate the crippling symptoms of depression. If you're not interested in pharmaceuticals, there's psychotherapy. And now, a new therapy called transcranial magnetic stimulation.
TMS, or transcranial magnetic stimulation, is part of a whole suite of treatments that are called neuromodulation treatments.
Treatments with TMS work by sending targeted magnetic pulses deep inside a person's brain.
By pulsing it with energy repeatedly, we're changing the way that area works, but also changing the way the whole brain network works.
The pulses stimulate parts of the brain that are underactive in people who suffer from depression. And it seems to work.
I would recommend it 100%. I have spoken to a number of people who have depression and given them my opinion. And I think it's a wonderful program. It's been a lifesaver for me. And I'm very grateful that I found it. And I'm very grateful for the people here.
UCLA doctors are investigating the treatment's potential to also help with diseases like schizophrenia, Parkinson's, epilepsy, and chronic pain. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Uplifting for many who participated, robots from around the world clashed here in Washington this week. We told you a couple days ago about the Afghan girls team that was originally denied travel visas to the United States, but let in just before the start of the annual event. VOA's Steve Barragona tells us it's part of a global competition bringing high school students together to learn tech, but also to learn to cooperate to solve important problems.
It's part soccer match, part science exhibit, part United Nations. The first global challenge brought high schoolers from nearly 160 countries to Washington. They built robots to sort blue balls from orange ones and deliver them to different parts of the playing field. With its spirit of friendly international competition, it's like a robotics Olympics, but better, says founder Dean Kamen.
But the sports in the Olympics aren't the sports that will give kids the skill sets, the vision, the courage, the technical expertise to take on the world's problems.
Kamen says these students are learning those problem-solving skills, along with the math, engineering, and programming prowess to be global tech leaders. But they also learn collaboration. Each match is 3-on-3. Teams have to cooperate to get the job done. Lita Azizi is with the Afghan team.
Every team has their own character to them. I can't say that we are good or they are good, but we are very excited and a bit nervous.
The Afghan team had extra challenges. An all-girl team in a male-dominated field from a country torn by conflict. Plus, their team was denied a visa twice. After an international uproar, President Donald Trump cleared them.
When we got rejected twice by the United States Embassy, we didn't feel defeated. We made our robot within 2 weeks, and we have our robot here. But we saw that God wanted us, and we got accepted. This time again, it is in God's hands. Whatever is in our destiny, but one thing is for sure, we will never lose our hope.
They did not win the most matches. Finland did. But that was never really the point, says Dean Kamen.
We've created a game where 160 robots are going to fight each other, and most of them will lose. But every kid that designed and built and sweated and worked over that robot has won.
Next year's competition will be in Mexico City. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
We'd like to thank everybody who is listening to our program today in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, on Helps Radio at Help University, and to everyone around the world who tuned in today. Thank you so much. You can join us online at VOA Asia Facebook, and of course, we're on our website, voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.